Imagine your computer catches a virus,
Right.
and you do everything perfectly. You delete the suspicious files, you run your top-tier antivirus, you change every single one of your passwords.
You might even completely wipe the hard drive just to be absolutely sure.
Exactly. You reinstall everything from scratch, you boot it back up, and you take a deep breath, and yet the attacker is like still watching you. They never left.
Because they aren't hiding in your files. They're hiding in the very foundation of how your machine decides, you know, what is real and what is a lie.
Yeah, and that's what we are getting into today on Cyber Mornings Daily. We are looking at a completely new breed of cyber attacks, where the systems designed to protect you are the exact weapons being used against you. So, welcome to another deep dive.
Glad to be here.
For you listening right now, we have a massive stack of threat intelligence reports and legal filings detailing three recent campaigns. I mean, we've got a supply chain attack targeting Linux users, a decade-long invisible infiltration by a nation-state group, and a multi-billion-dollar phishing as a service empire.
And, you know, while these three campaigns operate in completely different ways, they share this chilling common thread. These attackers, they aren't even bothering to pick the digital lock on the front door anymore. They are completely weaponizing the concept of trust itself.
Right. And as always, we're going to extract the clear takeaways and the practical impacts for you without, leaving you drowning in acronyms. So let's just jump right in. Let's start with this threat intelligence report on a supply chain attack targeting the Arch User Repository, or the AUR.
Yeah, the AUR. So to set the stage for you, the AUR is a massive community-driven collection of software packages for Arch Linux.
Huge repository.
Exactly. And recently, attackers actually managed to hijack over 400 of these packages. But looking at the report, they didn't do it by finding some brilliant, highly complex vulnerability in the code.
No, they just exploited human behavior and, honestly, administrative inertia. They targeted what the community calls orphaned projects.
Right, which are basically software packages where the original developer simply walked away. You know, people change jobs, they lose interest, or they just run out of time.
Yeah, life happens.
Exactly. They leave the project sitting there. The code is dormant, but it still has a long history, right? And therefore, it's still highly trusted by the community and by the automated systems that download it.
Okay, let's unpack this. It's like buying a house from a trusted neighbor, right? But the neighbor moved out, a squatter moved in, legally changed their name to match the neighbor, and then hid a key copying machine in the basement. You just trust the address.
That is a very accurate way to look at it, actually, because the attackers adopted these abandoned packages, but they left the actual core software completely intact.
Wait, really? Intact.
Yeah. If a user inspected the main program, it looked exactly like the application they originally wanted. The track was hidden entirely in the build instructions.
Oh, wow. Okay, let's talk about those build instructions because this is where the mechanism gets really devious. When you install software on Linux, you aren't always just downloading a finished product, right?
Right. Sometimes your computer downloads the raw materials and a set of instructions on how to put it together.
Right, the recipe.
Exactly. In the AUR, these instructions are found in files called the pkgbell or the .install script, and the attackers quietly altered these setup files.
So what did they add?
They added a really subtle command so that while your computer is busy compiling the software you asked for, it simultaneously reaches out to the internet and pulls down a malicious package in the background.
Just silently.
Completely silently. Initially, they used a package from the NPM ecosystem called Atomic Lock File, and later they actually switched to a bun package called JS Digest.
But I read in the report that they even spoofed the git commit metadata. Like, how does that actually work? Doesn't the repository system verify exactly who is uploading changes and when?
Well, it verifies the upload, but it often trusts the metadata provided by the uploader. Git commit history. I mean, the timestamps, the usernames, the log of changes, it's notoriously malleable unless it is cryptographically signed.
So they basically forged the digital paperwork.
Exactly. They faked the timestamps and the usernames so that if an administrator briefly glanced at the update log, it looked as though the legitimate, long-standing maintainer had simply returned to make a routine update.
Wow. So they completely bypass the manual review process. The reviewer sees a familiar name, assumes everything is fine, and approves it.
Yep.
Okay, so once that trap is triggered during the user's installation process, what exactly happens?
The malicious script drops a Rust-based credential stealer, And this specific malware acts like a high-powered vacuum for developer secrets.
Ouch. Like what kind of secrets?
It targets browser cookies, session data for applications like Slack and Discord, GitHub and NPM authentication tokens, SSH keys, Docker credentials. I mean, it is designed to steal the absolute crown jewels of a developer's workstation.
And it sends all these stolen secrets to an external domain called temp.ish. But the report mentions it routes this traffic through a Tor loop back proxy.
Right.
Why go through that extra step? I mean, why not just send the data directly out to the internet?
Because direct, unusual outbound traffic is noisy. Security software monitoring your network might flag a sudden burst of data going to some unknown temp.h address.
Oh, right. It would trigger an alert.
Exactly. So by using a Tor loop back proxy, the malware keeps the initial communication entirely local on the machine itself. It wraps the stolen data in Tor's heavy encryption before it ever hits your local network.
So to a monitoring tool, it just looks like an encrypted stream of data, masking exactly what is being stolen and where it is ultimately going.
Precisely.
That is incredibly slick. So if this hits a developer's machine, their entire digital identity is compromised. But as I'm reading further into this threat intel, it seems like the credential stealer is only half the problem. What happens if the person installing this package happens to do it with root privileges?
Oh, well, that is where the situation escalates from a severe breach to a complete system loss. If the malware detects that it has root access, meaning it has the highest level of administrative control over the computer, it deploys an eBPF rootkit.
Wait, let me stop you there. eBPF. I mean, I know a rootkit is essentially malware that buries itself deep in the system, but what exactly is eBPF and why does it make this so much worse?
Right. So eBPF stands for Extended Berkeley Packet Filter.
Catchy.
Very. But to understand it, think of the Linux kernel as the central brain of the operating system. It controls everything: the memory, the hard drive, the network card.
Right.
Historically, to change how the kernel works, you had to write complex, highly scrutinized kernel modules. But eBPF revolutionized this by allowing developers to write tiny, safe programs that run directly inside the kernel itself, originally for performance monitoring and networking.
Oh, so it's like a sanctioned way to inject custom code directly into the computer's brain.
Exactly. But attackers realize that if they can run code in the brain, they can alter what the brain perceives. So this rootkit uses eBPF to create what are called BPF maps, with names like hidden PIDs or hidden inodes.
Meaning it hides things.
It literally intercepts the commands that the operating system uses to check on itself.
Seriously, so if an administrator opens a terminal and types a command to see what processes are running or what files are in a folder, the kernel itself is lying to them.
Yes. The kernel checks its list, sees the attacker's malware, and simply deletes it from the output before showing it to the administrator. The malware hides its own processes, its files, its network connections. It becomes a ghost.
That is terrifying. Standard monitoring tools are fundamentally blind to it because the core system providing them information is compromised.
Exactly, which creates a massive practical takeaway for anyone managing Linux environments.
Yeah, if you find out you installed one of these compromised AUR packages, you can't just run an uninstaller. You can't even trust your antivirus if it tells you the machine is clean.
No, because the tools verifying the system is clean are relying on a compromised kernel. If that package ran with root privileges, you have to assume the machine is entirely lost.
You just have to burn it down.
Pretty much. You must rotate every single credential, your SSH keys, cloud tokens, browser sessions, and physically reinstall the operating system from trusted external media. Removing the package is not enough.
Man. Always check the PKGB cheap scripts before installing, especially on dormant packages. It's a profound lesson. I mean, they didn't break the software, they just inherited the trust we placed in its history.
Right.
Which brings us to our next source. If the AUR attack is about hiding a trap in a trusted software package, this next story is about attackers who didn't just hide in a package, they became the core system itself.
Yeah, if you thought inheriting trust was bad, wait until the attacker just rewrites the rules of who the server fundamentally trusts to log in.
Right. Let's introduce Velvet Ant. This is a China Nexus group that remained completely undetected inside a highly secure, isolated Linux network for nearly a decade.
A decade. Traces back to 2016.
And we're talking about an environment that was essentially air-gapped. It had no direct connection to the open internet.
Right. They managed to compromise an internet-facing web server and used it as a bridge, quietly tunneling their way into the deep, isolated segments of the network. But what makes Velvet Ant unique isn't just how they got in, it's how they stayed.
Right. They didn't drop a bunch of noisy traditional malware that scanners catch.
No, they opted for a strategy of profound patience by backdooring the fundamental Linux login systems themselves, specifically PM and OpenSSH.
Okay, so for anyone listening who isn't spending their days managing Linux servers, what role do those two systems play?
Think of them as the bouncers of the Linux operating system. PM, or pluggable authentication modules, is the core framework that decides whether the username and password you typed are correct. And OpenSSH is the protocol that allows administrators to log into the server remotely.
Okay, the bouncers.
Yeah. And Velvet Ant actually replaced the main modules of these systems with altered malicious versions.
And what did these altered versions do? Like, did they just let anyone in?
Not anyone. Some of these altered modules had a secret master password hard-coded directly into them. So no matter what the official company policy was, if the attacker typed in their secret phrase, the bouncer let them in.
Oh.
Yeah. And other modules were designed to quietly record the real, legitimate usernames and passwords as the actual employees logged in every single day, storing them in hidden files for the attackers to collect later.
Okay, wait, let me push back on this, because I know you listening might be wondering the exact same thing.
Hmm.
Let's say a company suspects a breach. A security analyst sees something weird on the network. Wouldn't standard incident response fix this? Doesn't forcing a network-wide password reset kick the attackers out?
That is a very common assumption. But if we connect this to the bigger picture, you'll see why normal containment completely fails here. When you force an employee to change their password, they pipe the new password into the system, and the login software verifies and updates it.
Right.
But in this scenario, Velvet Ant owns the login software. Ah.
They own the bouncer.
Exactly. If the very program checking your password is secretly working for the attacker, changing your password doesn't lock them out. It just politely hands them your brand new password. You are essentially doing their job for them.
That is brilliant and totally infuriating. You literally cannot trust the front door of your own server.
No, you can't.
And what's wild is that this group has a history of targeting the deepest blind spots in a network. I'm reading here that whenever defenders actually manage to spot them and try to eradicate them, they don't leave the network.
Yeah.
They just move to the hardware we ignore.
Yes. Threat researchers have tracked them habitually targeting unmonitored infrastructure, like F5 BIG IP appliances and Cisco and XOS switches, exploiting things like CVE-2024-2399. They deliberately seek out infrastructure that sits outside of normal endpoint monitoring.
But why a switch or a load balancer? I know a load balancer distributes network traffic so a website doesn't crash. But why does an attacker want to live there?
Because it is prime real estate with zero security cameras, a load balancer sits at the edge of the network. It processes every single piece of incoming and outgoing traffic.
Right.
And often it holds the SSL certificates, meaning it decrypts the traffic to inspect it before sending it to the internal servers. However, because these are specialized proprietary hardware appliances, you generally cannot install a standard antivirus agent or an EDR tool on them.
They're considered dumb appliances.
Right, and we trust them by default to just do their job.
So we put all our security cameras inside the building, but we don't point any at the traffic cop directing cars in the intersection.
Precisely. And that provides the clear practical takeaway for anyone responsible for network environments today. Infrastructure that sits outside normal monitoring, like login layers and load balancers, needs strict integrity checks against known good copies.
Yeah, you cannot rely on just installing security patches.
No. Velvet Ant didn't use a zero-day exploit to stay hidden for 10 years. They simply altered trusted programs after they got in. Verification is required, not just patching. You need to know exactly what your system is supposed to look like, down to the file hash, so you can recognize when it is lying to you.
It's just wild. We just saw how a highly sophisticated group patiently manipulated core infrastructure.
Mm.
But what happens when that exact level of deceptive infrastructure is packaged up, automated with AI, and sold to anyone for the price of a cheap gym membership?
Yeah, that is the million-dollar question, or in this case, the billion-dollar question.
Right. So our final source today is a fascinating legal filing from Google. They are suing a massive Chinese cybercrime network that operates a phishing-as-a-service kit, or FACE, called Outsider. And they used Google's own AI, Gemini, to generate fraudulent HTML and inline CSS to create these fake gift redemption and brokerage issue sites.
This case perfectly illustrates the commoditization of deception. They use Gemini to write the code because it bypasses security filters that usually catch malicious JavaScript.
Wait, I need to pause here. You said they used inline CSS to bypass security scanners. I always thought CSS was just a styling language. It tells the website what font to use, what color the buttons are. How do you actually steal credentials with formatting? Why wouldn't they just use malicious JavaScript?
Because modern security tools are specifically trained to hunt for executable logic. Antivirus software and email filters look for JavaScript because that is the code that actually does things. It runs scripts, it harvests keystrokes, it initiates downloads.
Okay, so it has action.
Exactly. CSS, on the other hand, is just for styling. It possesses no executable logic. So when a security scanner reads pure HTML and CSS, it sees absolutely nothing malicious to flag. It just sees a set of instructions on how to render a page visually.
But to the human eye?
To the human eye, that pure CSS perfectly mimics the exact layout, logos, and input fields of a legitimate bank or a trusted retail brand. The AI generates a flawless visual replica. The victim types in their credentials, and the standard, non-malicious HTML form submission sends that data straight to the attacker's server.
And there is no JavaScript for the scanners to catch at all.
None.
But how did they get the AI to write this for them? Don't models like Gemini have guardrails to prevent people from generating phishing sites?
Well, yes, but they bypass the guardrails by framing their prompts as harmless programming requests. They wouldn't ask the AI to build a phishing page. They would ask it for help designing a user interface or to create a CSS template for a gift redemption portal.
Ah, clever.
Yeah, the AI complies because, again, there is no inherently malicious payload in a CSS grid.
The scale of this operation is just staggering. Looking at the numbers from the FBI's Operation Ghost Hook and Operation Riptide, over 100,000 victims.
Yeah.
3.87 million stolen credit cards. And an estimated $1.9 billion in losses. And the kit costs as little as $88 a week or $200 a month via Telegram bot. You get over 290 pre-built templates, real-time keystroke logging.
It is essentially software as a service, but engineered for global fraud.
Here's where it gets really interesting to me. Looking at this legal complaint, they've essentially built a corporate org chart for cybercrime.
They really have.
The enterprise is broken down into these highly specialized departments. You've got the developer group updating the templates, the data broker group supplying the massive lists of target phone numbers, the spammer group managing the bulk texting tools, the theft group handling the money laundering, and they even have a Telegram group acting as human resources. It's like a Fortune 500 company structured entirely around sealing personal data at scale.
This raises an important question, though. It highlights how the barrier to entry has completely plummeted. In the past, running a campaign of this magnitude with this level of visual perfection required a highly skilled team of specialized developers.
Yeah, you had to actually know how to code to be a successful hacker.
Exactly. Now, AI is being weaponized via these harmless programming requests to scale attacks that used to require significant technical skill. A novice fraudster with absolutely zero programming knowledge can buy a weekly subscription, utilize AI to bypass scanners, and deploy a campaign that perfectly mimics trusted institutions.
So what's the practical takeaway for the listeners' own environments?
The volume and the visual perfection of phishing texts, you know, smishing, will only increase. We used to rely on typos, weird grammar, and ugly formatting as our primary indicators of fraud.
Right, the Nigerian prince emails with terrible spelling.
AI has completely eliminated those tells. You cannot trust a text message simply because it has the correct corporate logo and flawless grammar. Hypervigilance from the user is no longer optional. If you receive an urgent alert from your bank, you must close the message, open a browser independently, and navigate to the official website yourself. You can no longer trust the visual cues presented to you.
Wow. Taking a step back and looking at all three of these stories, a very clear, unifying picture emerges. Whether it's an abandoned open source project in the Arch repository, or the very login terminal of an isolated server manipulated by Velvet Ant.
Or a flawlessly coded text message from a trusted brand generated by AI.
Exactly. The core lesson here is that attackers are no longer trying to break the lock on the front door. They are tricking us into voluntarily handing over the keys. They've completely weaponized trust.
And as we wrap up this session, I want to leave you with a final thought to mull over. As AI continues to perfect the art of mimicking human communication and writing flawless, undetectable code, how long until we can no longer rely on our own eyes to verify what is real on our screens?
That is a heavy question.
If the foundational trust model of the internet collapses, how will we establish truth in the digital world tomorrow?
Yeah, we've gone from trusting the software we download to trusting the hardware running our networks to realizing we might not even be able to trust the very pixels we see. Keep your eyes open, verify everything, and never stop questioning the systems that ask for your trust. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Stay curious and stay safe.